Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, out of BC, across the nation, around the world, it's Left of the Valley with Kevin and Karen. Hi, Karen.
Hello, Kevin.
I did not butcher your name yet again. It's like three shows in a row.
Yay!
And we got a great show. We got a lot of things going on here today. We got our great guest. We got returning to us, our champion from the homeless cause. We got Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, guys.
Glad you're here.
You're almost like a regular now.
Glad to be here. What I'd like to know is, how do you butcher Karen's name? Like, what could you possibly do? Like, do you call her Jim? Like, what do you do?
I don't know. I just went...
Special talent.
Yeah, exactly. Special talent.
Okay.
And of course, as well, today, the guy's got to actually lead on the show is our good friend, Liam. Hi, Liam.
Hello.
Today he's going to be leading on the show, and we're talking today about the power of words.
Yeah.
Right? Well, we're not going to get into that right away. We've got a few things we got to do first, and I guess we should get into that. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to go...
Mail time.
We actually got the mail.
Mail.
I know! Now, I got a few little pieces of mail I want to share with you guys here. The first one was for actually the people like Cause, Tracy. Saying that...
Tracy Lister?
Yes, Tracy Lister that was with us in our last episode.
She's a founding member of the Citizens Against Urban Sprawl Society.
That's right. And thank you, Kevin and Liam, for having us on the show, because Karen, in the meantime, was gone somewhere else, and we're not sure where. Where were you?
I was in Quesnel. It's not that exciting.
No, that's not it.
No.
You were at the beer festival.
There.
Oh, yeah. Oh, actually, that was really good.
Yeah.
Mission Springs Brewing, great beer festival. I hope they repeat it. It was really worthwhile.
Yeah, it was obviously, you were on some kind of mission, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What did you find? Anything interesting?
Lots of beer.
Okay. Well, let's cut that real quick. And after that, I got this message here. From Jeff. Jeff, look at that. You were right here, and you actually sent me an email as well, thanking us and all that. And then you did something really, really nasty.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, after that he writes,
uh-oh.
Hey, guys, I just got a call from the CBC about after listening to your show, and the CBC called. You want to explain yourself on that?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
Because after that, he just admitted to me, no, that was just a joke, right?
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, what I think I said was thanks for the promotion, because shortly after appearing on your show, I got called by them. But yeah, that was
they weren't
connected. They
and
weren't
here
connected.
I thought we had like five listeners, including the CBC. So you did go on the CBC.
Yeah, they wanted to I guess just get an update on the public meeting that we had on Thursday, and talked a little bit about that. And thankfully they advertised it, and it was actually kind of neat because I met a couple people at the town hall meeting that heard about it from the radio show. So that was pretty cool.
Excellent. That worked well for you.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Good. Oh, I'm glad this went well, and people can find that in the archives of the CBC.
It's the show's on there. Some 5 or 10 minute show, not that big a thing, but the town hall went well. There was about 100 folks that came out from Abbotsford. Lots of questions, and hopefully we answered them to their satisfaction.
Oh, good stuff. Yeah. I would have went there too, but I have a face for radio, and I don't have a face. It was radio, but it wasn't television.
We will be having another public event probably in mid-September, so we'll let everybody know about that as well.
Beautiful.
Yeah. That's another step along the forward progress towards the Abbey Diggs Village.
Yeah, it's going to be, this is actually, the one that was on Thursday was hosted by the city. The next one's going to be hosted by Abbotsford Unitarian Society. It'll have a little bit of a different format. We're going to have a presentation. Hopefully we'll have one of our cabins there to show everybody what that'll look like,
nice.
Too.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
So stay tuned. We'll keep you guys updated on something like that. But, well, let's go in our segment.
Okay.
It's all yours.
Okay, this day in history. This day, jeez, never mind. August 30th. 30 BC.
It's going to be that kind of show, I think.
Cleopatra commits suicide.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And September 3rd, 1783, the Treaty of Paris is signed by the United States, Great Britain, Spain, and France to end the American Revolution. So 13 colonies formerly of Great Britain become independent. Boundaries agreed on were Florida, north to the Great Lakes, and the Atlantic coast west to the Mississippi River.
Hmm.
On August 31st, 1887, Thomas Edison received the patent for the kinetoscope and moving pictures. They weren't exactly born at that moment. That was a big step forward, but I just wanted to elaborate on this one a bit. Thomas Edison, he applied for the patent. He received the patent. He took the credit for creating the kinetoscope, which is an early form of a motion picture machine.
He was a shameless self-promoter.
Yes, well, the thing is, he actually gave the job to his assistant, William Dixon, gave him the idea of what he wanted and said, you go create this, which William Dixon did. And he was the one who turned the concept into a reality. He's the one who's now mostly given credit for creating this. But because Edison owned the lab and it was a collaborative lab, he took all the credit for anything that came out of it, even though he may have had very little to do with it.
So I guess this is a lesson here. Even if you try to fool people, eventually history will judge you for what you really are.
Yeah, and it wasn't like it was just coming out of his lab either. In France, Edison had met an inventor named Etienne Jules Marais, I think his name was. He had already developed the concept of using a roll of film to create moving pictures as opposed to like a drum, which is what had been used before. And the Eastman Company was inventing celluloid film. So really, William Dixon put all these things together and
cool.
made the final product. And this day in history, August 30th, 1962, Trinidad and Tobago gained independence from Great Britain. And finally, in 1967, Thurgood Marshall becomes the first African-American Supreme Court Justice in the United States. So his big deal was in 1954, he had won a case called Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka. That he won that case by arguing that the separate but equal principle of segregated schools was unconstitutional. So that was his big moment in his career as a lawyer, and then from there he was appointed by JFK to become the Supreme Court Justice. And that's all I got.
That's all you got. Well, that's good enough already.
Yeah.
All right. Now, people, have you ever wondered about the power of words, about what they mean? Liam, well, I'm sure you've thought about this once or twice.
Yeah, quite a lot, actually.
So this is the theme of our show today. We're going to discuss what words really mean.
So, in being skeptical, a lot of the times you come across a word that you think means one thing but is being used in a totally different way. So we're kind of going to discuss definitions and the power to mislead that using the wrong definition for a word can have. So I think we're going to start off with a very, very common one, theory. Probably all of you have heard theory misused horrendously.
Yeah, actually, I'm talking a bit about that in my rant later on.
Yeah, so when people...
When a creationist would say, well...
Evolution
is
only
just
a theory.
Yes.
People often use theory to mean hypothesis. If you have a theory, that means it has been tested and tested and tested and found to be true. And the reason that we call it a theory and not a fact is that if we discover new data, something new comes to light, we'll change what we thought, whereas a fact does not change.
So you're essentially saying it's a bit like looking at a dictionary, you realize one word will have several definitions to it, but people, when it comes to theory, they just look at that one theory that basically means an educated guess, a hunch.
That's a hypothesis. That's not even
a theory.
Not a theory. It's just a word that's misunderstood and misused.
If you look in the dictionary, the scientific definition for theory is not an educated
guess.
No,
but I'm talking like the casual, everyday definition.
And that'll
for theory.
Be three or four down, so you have to look for that
yes.
one.
Yes.
But I don't think it's accurate to position theory as subordinate to fact. They're quite different. In fact, a lot of scientists would say facts by themselves are quite powerless
yeah.
and useless, whereas theories actually are frameworks by which you can make
mm-hmm.
predictions and actually do work and accomplish things. They're much more powerful than simple yeah. facts.
Getting into our second definition, fact. And in science, a fact is an observation. It doesn't have any explanation tied to it. It's just what you observed.
Right.
And so by itself, it doesn't tell you much of anything
right.
because it's just a point form. This is what it was. It doesn't tell you why.
Right.
A theory is an explanation as to why that is.
So I observed that this show was a great show, and that's a fact, right?
No, because that's subjective.
So. No? You said no?
But then is it a fact for you? Like, we all have
no.
our... We all
yeah,
have
no.
our...
No.
Right, right, right? I was setting you up there. That's a softball. That's a softball.
You guys all fired.
So the observation or the fact would be perhaps that you have a hole in the foot of your sock or the bottom of your sock, and that is only an observation, but then you have to formulate your theory as to...
No. You formulate a hypothesis.
Hypothesis
which is
as
our
to
third definition.
Hypothesis as to why that hole is there.
A hypothesis is a proposition about why something might be. So you start with an observation. I observe there's a hole in my sock. And then your hypothesis is a possible explanation. It doesn't have any data behind it. It's just what might be the reason. It might be the reason that, you know, a rat chewed a hole in my sock. It might be that I walked on something really abrasive. They're all hypotheses. And then as you do further testing, you can figure out if one of them gets elevated to theory because everything agrees with it.
Okay.
So why do you have a hole in your sock?
I don't. Well, besides the one that was designed to be there so I could put my foot in.
yeah, all right. All socks need at least one hole, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, they're, what are they?
A
little bag?
By the way,
they're useless.
Liam and Jeff are here till Thursday. Same on their show at...
Yeah. Okay, now our fourth one will be law. Now... A common misconception is that if a theory is tested enough times, it will become a law. That is not at all the case. A law is like a fact, but an overriding fact that applies to everything. So like the law of gravity. Gravity isn't something that you would only observe in one circumstance. It applies to everything in existence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we call it the law of gravity because it's a set of rules that apply to everything, but there's no explanation involved. It's
mm-hmm.
just this is the way things behave, not why they behave that
so
way.
So it's an observation, but not just a specific observation. It's one that applies to all...
Well, the dictionary says, a statement or a relation or sequence of phenomena invariable under the same conditions.
Okay.
So,
it's more widespreading than a simple
yes.
fact. Yes.
I didn't understand a word of what you guys said.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
What about words that aren't even really, they shouldn't even be words? They are words, but they shouldn't be words. I'll give you an example. Evolutionism.
Yeah.
Now that's a word, but it's not a word used by scientists. It's a word that's been created, I think, and adopted by people that want to try to demean it, or things like
mm-hmm.
scientism. I mean, you don't hear those words used in the scientific community.
No.
They're used in political realms, or
there's kind of two ways you can get a word. You can get a word because you observe something that you need a name for, or you can get a word because it's slang and becomes adopted as
colloquial
a real word.
Colloquial
yeah.
usage. Yeah.
So it's words like scientism or something that's used often enough that dictionaries recognize they exist,
right,
but don't necessarily have a good definition tied to them.
But they, but when you have a word and it's recognized by a dictionary, it gives it sort of a sense of credibility, which
yeah.
I don't know if it always should. Just because a bunch of idiots use a word
doesn't make it a good word.
It doesn't lend credibility to the concept of it. And I don't know. That's those are two that really bother me.
I think that brings up a good point in that I think people in general, but certainly people who are talking about scientific ideas, should be very careful in their language, because a word like that, like Darwinism, that is,
right,
it's an invented word that is just used to cause doubt or so discredit.
Well, wait a minute. But, you're saying they're trying to cause doubt?
But if you just if we are more careful that, about what we say,
you just ignored me right there. You just completely ignored me.
Careful about what we say, then that gives less ground for people to take those words and create confusion.
I can think of a couple instances where, like, Richard Dawkins has referred to himself as an evolutionist.
Yes.
So even though that's not really a good word, because he's using it, it does give a certain credibility to it.
Yes.
You know?
Well, we should send him an email about that.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure Richard will get over that right away.
Yeah. He's appearing on the show next week, isn't he?
Yeah, we're working on that.
Yeah. Okay, so the next one applies directly to evolution, actually, and that is fittest. Now,
in survival of.
Survival of the fittest. People all the time, when they say that, they think survival of the biggest, strongest individual. That is not at all what it means. The fittest is the best adapted to survive.
Fittest for a certain environment.
So if you're living in an environment where to be a thin, weak computer nerd is the best thing for you to survive, then that is the definition of the fittest for that environment.
You weren't looking at Jeff when you said that. Jeff is not a thin, weak computer nerd.
But it's just the fittest has nothing to do with your physical condition. It's all to do with whether or not you're adapted to survive in your environment.
So therefore, environmental changes are usually what is at the base of the mutation that promote...
Not mutation, but it does change what's selected.
Okay. It will change, and it will be at the base of environmental... evolution.
Yeah.
So it's usually a change in the environment that will promote this
kind of... There's a theory, punctuated equilibrium, it's called, where as long as the environment doesn't change, very little evolution goes on. But as soon as a massive environmental change occurs, you have a period of very rapid evolution, because all the previous top animals die and new ones can fill their niches where previously they would have been killed off.
What's the name of the guy who's the biggest advocate of that theory?
I don't know.
Oh, okay, we'll find it.
Just call me Squid. Sorry. That was a little quote from...
Just call me Squid?
From
that's rapidly evolved.
Yes.
That's from Ice Age 2.
Yes, Ice Age 2.
Oh, jeez. Well, that was a reference right there. We just crashed the show.
Anyway, go ahead, Leo. I'll just keep quiet now.
Well, Jeff is finding a name for us.
Don't wait for me. This could take a while.
Yeah,
okay. I'm not a skinny computer geek. I don't even know how to use this thing.
Great radio.
Okay. So then we get into statistical significance. This is one that is kind of an out-of-the-hat definition, but I do hear it misused a lot, so I decided to include it. Whenever you do a statistical analysis, you can observe something and then think that it's just chance, right? You'll have a bunch of random results that you kind of have to discredit because they're equal to being just a chance occurrence. There's not necessarily any connection between what you're testing for and this result because it could be just chance. So when you say something is statistically significant, that means that you've observed it at a rate greater than that given to chance. So it has occurred enough that you can say that actually happened because of what I'm testing for, and it wasn't just a chance occurrence.
Right.
Being statistically significant doesn't make it terribly important or statistically relevant, so to speak, because, you know, it could just be like the tiniest fraction of a percent greater than chance. So often people will say, oh, there's a statistically significant, you know, occurrence that happened that means that this is wrong. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing or totally wrong.
Or it doesn't
just
discredit your particular hypothesis.
It's just detectable. All you're saying is that you can detect that it's there, not that it's having a big impact.
Right. But I have certainly heard that used. There's a statistically significant amount of X, and therefore your hypothesis is discredited. But
even though it could be like one part per million.
Yeah,
or something.
It might mean nothing at all. Right.
And the,
it just has to be recorded by the scientist as something that did happen, and you've taken note of it.
And when they talk about statistical chance, they're talking one in six, right? Is chance?
Well, it depends on what you're testing for.
No, I mean
for,
the
right?
usual chance.
Usual,
yeah,
but
it's about one in six, right?
I don't know. I don't know what you mean.
It depends entirely on what
if
you're testing.
You're playing dice.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're playing dice.
Stephen Jay Gould was the paleontologist that I was thinking
of. Oh,
about.
Yes.
In 72, he wrote the paper Punctuated Equilibria with Niles Eldridge.
When did he die? You guys remember that?
I do not.
Not
know.
Too long ago. It's not long ago. He was even in featured in The Simpsons at one time. So.
Yeah.
That's the kind of knowledge I have.
Yeah.
See, you got Liam there with his great knowledge. And the kind of knowledge I have. Woo-hoo, I know about The Simpsons.
We made an Ice Age reference.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay.
May 20th, 2002, at the age of 60. Very young.
Oh, yeah, that's sad.
And who else just recently passed? Was it Attenborough, the gentleman that does
yes,
all...
and so did Victor Stanger.
Stanger?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, like 2 days ago, not even.
He must be pretty young, too. I can't even believe he's... He must
Stanger?
Be in
the 60s. No. He's up there in age.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Wow. It's too bad we're losing a lot of heavyweights.
Yeah. That's a shame. Anyway, sorry, Liam. We're stopping
okay.
your segment
so,
there.
The next ones are also huge ones. Quantum and quantum physics.
I was waiting for this.
Some of my favorites.
You got a Deepak Chopra drop there by any chance?
You know what? I'm going to look for that. I am so going to look for that. So you guys talking, I'll look
okay.
for
Deepak.
Can I just, before you say that, so we were Liam and I were having a conversation the other day, and he's like, well, quantum, do you know what quantum means? And I opened my mouth thinking, of course I know what quantum means. And then when I started thinking about it, I just closed my mouth again because I actually had no clue what quantum actually means.
Not many people seem to know what quantum means. Now, quantum kind of has two definitions that are relevant to us. The first one is its dictionary definition, having to do with values, or a quantum is a value. So if I were to use that in ordinary conversation, I could have a quantum of a certain product or something.
Quantum of flour.
And so in physics, that's important because on a classical physics level, some things, particularly light, are seen as a constant value. It's just a continual flow, a wave. But then when you look at it on a very small scale, as in quantum physics, you realize that it's made of particles or photons, units of light, so to speak. And so you say that you have quantized light because you have divided it from a constant flow into a bunch of discrete units that can't be further divided.
Right.
So that gave the name to quantum physics because they realized that on a small scale some things are made of tiny quanta, so they called it quantum physics. But quantum physics does not only deal with quanta. It deals with anything smaller than an atom. So if I say that, you know, quantum physicists are doing this, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with quantizing. It's just on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
So very often, as with Deepak Chopra, people will throw quantum in there because it sounds cool and gives them some credibility.
Yeah,
I
just pulled up the what they call the random Deepak Chopra quote generator.
Yes,
which is just
fun.
I just got one here. Should I do the accent? Does he have a? Yes, he's got.
I have no idea.
Quantum physics meditate on karmic observations.
See, so
that's just beautiful.
Because there is a certain uncertainty involved with quantum physics, lots of New Age types, as Deepak Chopra, like to seize on it as a justification for their wacko belief.
The human nervous system is at the heart of mortal reality.
Yeah. See? So, so it's important you can kind of check it through your mind. Does using quantum in that way actually make sense? In most cases, it won't.
This is a really interesting quote by Richard Feynman. This is all I know about quantum physics. If you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics. Richard Feynman.
Yeah.
Yes. I also like this one, another one from Deepak. Evolution arises and subsides in unparalleled silence.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, I just got to receive more of this wisdom.
Didn't we see Richard Dawkins debating Deepak Chopra?
Yeah, there is a debate.
And yeah, Deepak Chopra just went on and on about all these quantum things, and then at the end someone asked Dawkins his response, and he's like, I have no clue what he said. Like, it didn't make any sense.
Yeah, he debated that. Also, I think he debated Lawrence Krauss, too, I think.
If you ever get a chance on this exact topic with Deepak Chopra, there was a debate. It was on Nightline. It was Sam Harris. It was, what's the other guy's name? Who's the guy that the big uproar on the Facebook?
Richard Dawkins?
No, on our Facebook. That we were going to bring him in. He was invited in, but there was that.
Richard Carrier?
No. That controversy about that one atheist speaker. I can't get his name.
I can't remember either. No. It'll come to us anyway.
Anyway, Sam Harris and him were debating Deepak Chopra and a couple other people, and Deepak went into this whole quantum mechanics stuff with consciousness and non-locality. He was just throwing words around, and it actually sounded quite poetic, but it was very confusing. And then a question came from the audience, and the guy's name was Leonard Mlodinow, and he is a particle physicist. And then the interviewer asked him, does it make any sense? Do you understand what Deepak just said? And his answer was something like, well, I understand what all the words mean that he said, but I have no idea what he's talking about. And it was very comical. If you ever get a chance, look for that interview. It was really funny.
So, go ahead. So, quantum.
So, be wary of quantum.
Be wary of quantum.
Yes.
So, we were also discussing this earlier, and it seems like quantum physics should have properly been renamed subatomic physics or something like
physics
that.
Physics of very small things.
Yes, but it didn't get renamed, and now everyone's confused.
Well, I think part of the reason is quantum sounds cool. Mm-hmm. People like to use quantum because it makes them sound smart. But in most cases, if I say a quantum X or a quantum Y, it's really just referring to it being very small. It has nothing to do with quantization or separating it into small values, which is kind of why it has two definitions. There's
on the verge of finally understanding that old show, Quantum Leap.
Well, I was going to say, what about Quantum Leap? That's a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so Quantum Leap had
that's
nothing
wrong.
To do
totally
with being
wrong.
Quantum or anything.
So it's a small, big leap.
That's another kind of use that became accepted because people used it that way, but not because it was actually the definition. So a quantum leap is the only time that you can use quantum to mean big, and it has nothing to do with the definition of quantum.
I think I have a theory that they use quantum so much because the letter Q is so unused in everyday life, unless you're French. So
actually,
they just needed a word.
You have a hypothesis.
Oh, that's a good one.
We have to be more careful. Say things.
Okay, so then
carrying on.
I like including this one. Science. Now you probably all think you know what science is, but like, well, what's science?
that is the study of observe or maybe the
see
study of observable phenomenon and trying to explain them. That's my
you've just been put on the spot there.
Okay, Jeff, your turn.
Well, I would say it's a methodology. It's an approach. That's what I would say.
Scientific approach.
Science?
Yeah, it's a way of determining truth. It's a method by which we
that would be the scientific method. Science itself is just the systematic study of the physical world through observation and experimentation.
I'd like to point out that he didn't even turn to ask me that. He just thought, I'll ask the guys who actually have a chance of answering. He just said, Kevin, no way,
so
it's not going to happen.
Science is the idea that you can observe reality and then notice patterns and learn about it through that observation. Which seems kind of...
Isn't that what I said, kind of?
Sort of. it's pretty common sense when you think about it. And people have been scientists without knowing it since as long as they've asked questions. But now we kind of have to differentiate because there's all kinds of people who would like to come to a conclusion and then just find some facts to back them up afterwards. And so we need to really notice the flow of observation then experimentation to find your knowledge, as opposed to decide what you're going to find, then search for observations that back you up.
Mm-hmm.
I personally like what Bill Nye said about science. He says, the best idea we ever had.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of our Christian friends or religious friends try to create a false equivalency between their worldviews and their dogmas with science and just saying, well, it's just another way to see the world. It's just, you know, we've got the Christian worldview, we've got the scientific worldview. There's there's just a couple different ways of looking at things, which is really unfair, I think, to science.
The only way that you could do that and be legitimate is if you say that observation is not a good way of coming to truth, and that by seeing things you don't actually prove that they're there.
Right.
Which, you know, although that kind of sounds good on paper, in the real world, you will not get anything done if you refuse to accept what your senses tell you.
Right.
Well, unless you're a brain in the vat. Unless you live in some kind of matrix, right?
The whole issue with that, though.
That's way too quantum.
I'm getting quantum here.
Where's my generator?
The issue with
generator?
That is that as a brain in the vat, you're still living in the vat world, right? And so what you observe in the vat world will be what affects you every day. And so knowing about that will actually be important to you.
Let's not get into that. I'm going to call Matt Dillahunty on you. He'll give you a piece of his mind on that.
You reminded me of something that one of my, I don't know, elementary school science teachers told me about when you said that people have a tendency to decide that they have a hypothesis and then look for facts to back that up. He was telling us about the discovery of penicillin and how it was actually some other scientific experience kind of gone awry, and this guy just was observing so carefully that he saw that particular mold and knew it wasn't supposed to be there, and instead of just throwing it out and saying, okay, this experiment didn't work, he just went with that particular mold and discovered penicillin. So
there's been a lot of accidental discoveries.
Teflon is another good one.
No. Sticky notes.
Yeah.
Seriously, 3M, at 3M they were trying to create the super glue, and when they're going through all these experiments, they found one that didn't quite work, and some guy said, hey, we could do this with it, and they came out with sticky notes. It was a failed glue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was also the same thing with the windshield. You know why it cracks? It doesn't shatter and glass all over. And there's a coating of plastic, and that was discovered. I forget the name of the guy, but he dropped his beaker, and it fell on the floor, but it cracked, but it didn't shatter, right? And that's how that compound was discovered.
Cool. Calcium carbide is another one used to produce acetylene. They were looking to make an insulator, but it didn't work, so they threw it all in the river, and then it produced acetylene gas, and the river caught on fire.
Wow, that was spectacular.
That's cool.
There's also Viagra.
That was an accident? You know what? I don't even want to know how they found out that one by accident.
They were trying to create a medicine for high blood pressure, and it had the side effect of...
Wow.
Right, Jeff? Jeff and I know about this, right, Jeff?
Well, that's what they told me during the testing.
Yeah, we know about this stuff.
Michael Shermer was the name I was struggling for before.
Oh,
though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, leaving Viagra, going back to science.
So we get to our kind of final one, which is scientific method, which is quite a strict method for how you go through things to discover what is true, and it uses most of our other
definitions
we've come up with, definitions, where you start with an observation, you see something, you wonder why that happens, and so you then hypothesize, you come up with what might be a reason, you experiment, record your observations during your experiments, and if your hypothesis agrees with the new observations, then it has a greater chance of being true. And if it doesn't agree, you discard it. It was wrong. And you try another hypothesis. And eventually, if you do enough testing and rigorous enough testing, you can decide that your hypothesis is likely enough to be true that it's a theory. And you continue testing until it gets to the point where some theories are hardly even questioned because they've been tested so many times that we're fairly certain they're the truth.
Right. Yeah. I think that's an important point. That's actually one of the strengths of science, is that if scientists look at their data and they decide, you know, that, okay, this isn't right, and we can discard it, and we can take new information, and we can make new observations. Where, you know, a lot of religious people think that's a weakness, and they say, oh, look, science is wrong. They thought that was right, but they were proved wrong, and look at that. They just don't know anything. But that's the only way you come to know things.
It would be a weakness if we couldn't move on afterwards.
Yes, yeah.
We can say we were wrong, and now we're going to find what's right, then
exactly.
We're always the most accurate of anyone.
Yeah. Science has a self-correcting mechanism.
I can't remember the guy's name. I think he was a guy running for Senate in the U.S. and he was a Christian minister. And
let me get the banjos.
He came out, and he had a chemistry book from like the local high school. And he looked at it, he threw it on the table. He goes, "Look at that! whatever the fundamentals in chemistry, revision 7. He goes, see, they just can't get it right. He plopped the Bible down there.
Oh,
he goes, look at that. They got it right from the start.
Wow.
He used that revision or that updating reality as the fact that it's just they never get it right. And it was a point against it in his mind. It was quite comical.
Was his Bible in Greek, though?
No. It was, hey, look, if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me.
Yeah. It was written in the original English.
Yeah.
Just like Jesus wanted.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's yeah. Okay, well, you know, we could probably do an entire different podcast on just the kind of kooky stuff that happens in the U.S. politics.
Oh, my goodness.
So, any more definitions? Or?
That was the list. Any
that
more
one,
you
that
can
was
think
the list?
Of?
Well, that went by way too fast.
Well, so recap the theme. Is it how words are misused, or is it just crazy words? Like
scientific definitions that you should know because they're very often misused.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think the problem is that popular culture takes things, you know, and assumes them for their own and sort of redefines them. Which, for a lot of words, that's not really a big deal. But if you're talking about scientific terms, and if they are being manipulated and used against you, as your chemistry textbook revision shows that those are used to support a certain worldview that doesn't have, you know, anything else to support it. So when they're abused in that way, so that they can actually change policy and people can use those words to promote a point of view that doesn't have any kind of scientific basis, then that's when that's dangerous. And
well,
I think that's the thing that we have to keep in mind, that accurate definitions and people knowing them, that, you know, the more you know, the
perfect example is with the creationists, equal time creationists in the States, right?
Right.
Where they have, well, equal time for opposing theories. Evolution is a theory. The Bible is a theory. So both get equal time. That was the logic. The flaw with that logic was evolution is a theory, the Bible is a hypothesis. So you can say, sure, equal time for every theory, but you have to prove that you're a theory first, right?
Well, this is the classic false dichotomy with that, is that evolution is one answer and Genesis is the other, and that there's only two answers. I mean, evolution could be completely wrong. We could find out that it's wrong one day. It
doesn't
verify
Genesis,
creation.
Right,
no, right.
Yeah.
So it's completely...
Yeah, make the Bible right. No.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I just wanted to say that would you guys agree that maybe it's correct to say that science doesn't prove something right? It just disproves. I shouldn't say disproves.
Well,
it just proves what is wrong.
In statistical analysis, you'll have what they call the null hypothesis, which is the assumption that there's nothing causing this, that it's just no relation between what you're trying to relate. And in order to...
No relation between what I'm trying to relate.
So I have, like, observation...
What about my random Deepak Chopra quote? Who has most correspond to humble neural networks?
You have your observation, say, like, lots of fish are dying. And then you have your other observation, there's a chemical plant dropping stuff in the water. So your hypothesis that you want to promote is that they're related. The null hypothesis is that they're not related. In order to make your hypothesis more valid, you try and disprove the null hypothesis. And for every new null hypothesis that you prove wrong, yours looks better and better. And then when you've disproved enough null hypotheses that you're pretty sure yours is right, you try and disprove your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't ever really prove something right, because there's a chance that there's some new data that you didn't have. But you can always prove something wrong.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
what science does.
In science, you subject everything to rigorous testing, and if you can prove that it's not right, then you discard it. And through that process of elimination, you come up with the most likely candidate for the truth.
And is it the reason you figure why Christians or religious people in droves fight science so hard is because they know that science will not prove God right, but it might prove him wrong anyway.
Well, if you made religion undergo rigorous testing, it would most certainly be proven wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
This isn't really a word, but it's more of a phrase. You touched on it earlier. I think it sort of fits with what we're talking about here in terms of it being misused. Survival of the fittest. It's, in fact, did Darwin even say that? Or that wasn't coined by Darwin, was it? I don't think it was.
That's a good question.
I don't think it was. But nonetheless, it certainly is an aspect of evolution. But a lot of creationists try to disprove evolution by saying that's not a good way to run our society. They try to translate it into morality.
Yeah, social
when that concept is it's talking about the mechanisms between how organisms evolve and how they change, and that's just saying that's how, it doesn't say how it's how we humans should create a society, but they always make that leap.
Evolution is acting on us right now, whether we like it or not. Right? It's a natural occurrence.
But it's the misuse of that concept and to translate it into
that's also a misuse of fittest, because that implies that it's just whoever does the worst stuff to make everyone else die so they survive. But in a social environment, the fittest is someone who helps others and through that betters themselves so that they can have more kids and be better respected and less attacked. You know,
it's a complete perversion of the whole concept. Anyways, that's sort of what I was trying to get to.
Yeah, that's like a social Darwinism idea and they say that, you know, we're gonna stomp on all the like homeless people or whatever because the fittest would do that. But that's besides not understanding the whole theory of evolution. You're right. It's not meant to translate to a social aspect. That's not what it is. It's on a genetic level. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you choose to have happen or anything that you choose to do. It's which genes are going to be passed on to your offspring, which offspring are going to survive because they have a certain genetic code that allows them to survive. It's not ever a choice. It's not a choice of your actions.
And even if you dug in a little bit deeper, I think Liam's point is that it's not likely that the biggest, strongest, toughest, sharpest teeth person organism is going to be successful anyways. It's likely something altruistic is going to be more successful. So it's a complete perversion of that whole concept, and that's something that's always bothered
me. One other thing about evolution that needs to be pointed out, evolution is not an answer to biogenesis. A lot of Christians have a tendency to think evolution explains the origin of life. It does not.
No.
It just explains the mechanism by which it creates. It changes. But the creation of life is not explained by evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to use that as a weakness of evolution, but evolution never talks about that. Mm-hmm. Evolution talks about what happens after it started, and it gives the process by which that would work, but it doesn't talk about how it started. So it can't be indicted for not having that as part of the theory.
And since we were talking a bit about the scientific method too, I think a lot of people don't realize that science starts with observation and then explains. Very often I get the attitude where it's like, oh, well, you came up with evolution, and then you look for a bunch of stuff that supported it, now you're saying it's right. When in reality, we observed that evolution existed, and then we went to study that and figured out how it worked. Right.
Oh, long before Darwin, the accepted explanation was creation, special creation. And that's the way it was for thousands of years until the observation started not fitting with that.
Well, and he didn't just pull evolution out of a hat either. He observed that, you know, there were fossils of organisms that no longer live, that, you know, it looked like continents had drifted. Like, he realized that things had not always been as they were now.
Right.
And even people were actually putting evolution to their own purpose before Darwin articulated the theory anyway, because all these things, all these plants that we have hybridized, animals that we have, you know, kept the ones that we
breeding.
Want because it's selective breeding, you know, all these things are a form of evolution that we have helped along the way. So it's pretty disingenuous for people to deny that it exists when we benefit from it every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we go into the show going into evolution, because it's not a show about that, we'll do another show about that. Is there a segment about things that make you go, I'd like to have your opinion on this and the distinct panel I have with me today. Did you guys know that there is an app now? An app that's called Shut Up Devil app.
I'm still waiting for the devil to text me.
I know. We had a show. Jeff, you were there for that one, I don't think. We had a show where we found out that a priest was complaining. I think it was in Portugal or something like that. He was complaining that the devil was constantly texting him.
I heard that story.
That was just so funny.
Did he text back?
Well, the devil?
No,
would you
text back
to the devil?
Well,
I would, and I'm still waiting for him to text me.
Yeah, I would. I answer all my texts.
I don't know if it's an answer to this, but this one here, there's an app that was designed for Apple and Android that offers the power to silence Satan. It was of course. It was created by Winkler, and I'm not talking about the pawns here. It's Henry Winkler. He's an evangelist, obviously. Quote, A couple of years ago, I awoke to a series of thoughts and nagging accusation reminding me of my every sin. And apparently he's sure that that wasn't God or angels. And you think the devil would want to do more than that, right? You think the devil would say, stop accusing you of doing your sins, and say, hey, way to go, bud. Do some more of that stuff, right?
Yeah,
you
think.
No. He thought for sure it was. So this guy was convinced that this was spiritual warfare. And I should have some kind of war drop here, but I don't. And he was being attacked by Lucifer. So he referred to Scripture as a way to fight back. Because it says Jesus and Paul and all these guys use Scriptures and Bible verses out loud to repulse and ward Satan's attack. Vade retro satana. That's
okay.
Latin. This makes me sound good.
Get behind me, Satan.
That's right.
Quantum.
So apparently this app... apparently this app, you can look it up, and you can look up verses, you can set alarms and reminders for when you need to read out loud those passages.
These are just like scriptures that are particularly good at repelling Satan.
Yeah, anti-devil scriptures.
I would think so.
Anti-devil scriptures.
I tried to find the app. I did not find the app. Maybe somebody that's better researcher than me can find it. Apparently it's been downloaded by over 9,000 people to date.
Do you have to pay for it?
I don't know. I haven't found it. I was looking for it. I was, I went on to iTunes and I was looking for...
It'll be on the App Store.
Yeah, but
how
I did not
How much would
find.
You pay to repel the devil?
$6.99.
$6.99 app? Is it a $5.99?
No,
so, do I not need
$6.66.
Do I not need my garlic necklace anymore? Or is
that's
vampire.
A vampire.
Oh, okay.
So yes, you still need your garlic.
Still need that.
Yeah. So, any thought on the app? Anybody wants to buy one? Or?
No, I'm not going to buy it. I'm still waiting for Satan to text me.
Well, you'd think you could just, have a Bible with you and you wouldn't need to buy an app.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it takes a while to flip through those pages, though.
What if
you
have
one
of those really honky Bibles, too? It's huge.
You can get, a little New Testament. That's pretty pocket-sized.
Yeah.
You could just go talk to the Jehovah's Witnesses on the corner every day and they'd probably repel the devil for you.
Yeah, I just think that God is finally trying to catch up to the devil because, the burning bush thing is, way past age.
Yeah,
right?
That's
like,
true.
He's trying to catch up to the 21st century. Okay.
Jeff's being very quiet. He actually bought that app. No, he doesn't have to admit it.
Well, I can show you how it works.
Oh, God. All right. Oh, well, that was quick and easy. I guess we'll do another
brilliant moment brought to you by religion.
Well, I want your opinion on this one. Have you guys ever heard of Gordon Klingenschmitt?
Yes,
nope.
I have.
Yeah, he's a bit of a wacko. He's got his own show, like us, but nowhere near as good as we are. And it's called Pray in Jesus' Name.
Hmm.
Yeah, conservative radio, obviously. And he interviewed John McTernan of USA Prophecy. Now, USA Prophecy, when you get a site like that, you know it's going to be good, right? This fellow claims, apparently, that every natural disaster since 1991 is God's wrath because America is interfering with God's plan for Israel. Yeah, you just see the logic, right? He says basically that the U.S. is pressuring Israel to stop expanding and grabbing land from Palestinians, which of course results in stuff like Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Andrew, the tornadoes in Joplin, etc. And of course, these people obviously never heard of climate change. I wonder if you guys have any thoughts on this.
Why 1991? What happened then?
I don't know why 1991. The article didn't say, and I couldn't find, but I guess 1991 is when the U.S. started, or Israel might have put a bit more pressure on Palestinians to develop down there. I don't know.
Oh, well, the Gulf War started in 1991.
Well, there we go. Maybe that's it.
Desert Shield.
Yeah. My first question was, if God is sending tornadoes and storms like that, why is he always angry at uninhabited planets? There's a massive storm on Jupiter right now. And if he's doing this to you know, to stop the gays or something like that. I mean, there must be a lot of gays on Jupiter.
Well, no, I don't think Jupiter ever supported Israel.
You know,
I mean,
they've never
come out in support of Israel.
Was this just storms in the States, or was it storms all over the world? Like,
well, you know,
Japan being punished because it's not supporting Israel?
He said the storms, and because the U.S., you know, maybe God is punishing the rest of the world with storms because it's the U.S.
Is this like the thing where the teacher punishes the whole class to get the one person who
did
it?
You got it. Now you understand.
Yeah.
So that's effective.
So is there a massive storm on Uranus right now, you guys figure?
So the
that just went silent.
The storms are because of the treatment of Israel, and the terrorist attacks is because of the U.S.'s progressive attitudes towards same-sex marriage. That's how that works, right?
Yeah, we're never exactly sure. It seems to be either way, you know. Yeah. It seems that as soon as you're doing something that's not exactly in the Bible, there's a storm somewhere.
But why doesn't he just say, like, maybe don't do that? Like, a storm is a very kind of passive-aggressive, not really getting at the root of the issue way of dealing with
this. You're right. That is very passive-aggressive.
Well, this is why I prefer Zeus, because Zeus, at least, you know, would throw a thunderbolt at you. It hit one person, you know, instead of sending a storm. I mean, come on.
But
it's way more precise.
The thing is, God used to do that. He used to talk to Moses. He used to talk to specific people. Why doesn't he not do that anymore?
Oh, well, this is funny, because you got a religious denomination, which... Oh, God, which one is it? I forget now. But they came over that moment by saying that God used to speak to people before Jesus came. But now since Jesus came, we have the Word, and God doesn't need to talk to us anymore. We should be big enough to figure it out on our own.
Oh.
It's a great way to get over this, right?
Hmm. Well, that happens with the mafia as well. When the guys are at the beginning, they're actually, you know, they're putting out their own hits, they're giving out their own orders, but once you get to a certain level, you don't talk to anybody. All your directions come through your underlings. That's Organization 101 for those big, powerful organizations. So. Oh. That makes sense.
So
yeah,
you're saying God
is
like the mafia?
Yeah, he's like
Don
Corleone. He doesn't talk to anybody.
Ah.
Oh, goodness.
So then is like the Pope is now like the next down? Is like a henchman? And
I'm not sure because he's doing a lot of talking. He's saying Pope Frank says a lot of things. In fact, this should be a topic of one of your shows. I don't think Pope Frank is actually a Christian. I think he may be an atheist.
Oh, I don't know. I think, to do a bit of a tangent here, I think the Pope has a wonderful, wonderful spin machine behind him, and everybody's like enamored with the guy. But when you look at the policies of the Church, they haven't really changed. You know, Africa is still, you know, rife with people saying that no, AIDS is bad, but you know, condoms are worse. So he looks like he's doing a lot of change. He's making these big proclamation on the surface that makes the press real quick, but after that, it goes back to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how much can a Pope do? I mean, like, look at Barack Obama too. He's got a lot of neat ideas, and but there's very little he can do. You can't, one man, even in the highest office, can't completely change a whole organization or a whole system. But it's step one. It's step one, right?
It would seem like the Pope could just like ask God to fix it, though.
What is it?
What
did Christopher Hitchens call him? God's vicar on earth or something?
The vicar of Christ.
Vicar of Christ.
Something. Yeah, that's what
the Pope
is supposed
to have
a
direct line to God, isn't he? Like,
yeah, that's what I thought. I heard an interesting thing. A woman interviewed Pope Frank, and she asked him about his views on women in the Church and if that was going to change, if they'd be able to become priests, so to speak. And he just blew it off. He laughed, and then he said, well, you know, women always have the power because they basically tell their husbands how to think, or tell, you know, the housekeeper at the Vatican can sort of tell the priests what to think, and they're going to change their mind and listen to her. That was basically the premise of what he said.
You can't handle the truth.
I mean, that was an argument that was given against women getting the vote too. Oh, well, you know, you can tell your husband how to vote, and that's what he'll do. Give me a freaking break.
Women are allowed to vote?
Yeah.
Really?
How did we lose that one?
Yeah.
Totally kidding.
Yes.
Took him a while.
We totally lost that thing. No, that was a good thing. It was a good thing because we need women.
Thanks for clarifying
that.
Because
like
otherwise...
questionable. Wow.
No, not questionable at all. I was just receiving a word from God there. He was just sending me... Yeah.
God uses Morse code?
He does. He's catching up. He's catching up.
Slowly but surely.
Although I can't, I don't know how to decrypt Morse code, so all he says is da dee da dee da. Well, that was,
right.
As it was an enlightened show, wasn't it?
Yeah, wow. This kind of degraded.
Hey, are you saying our show is not going to evolve and we're going to basically fail?
Here's another definition. Devolve. Okay, species do not devolve. They evolve. Because evolution always goes towards whatever makes you best able to survive. Doesn't necessarily make you more intelligent or prettier, but it makes you better able to survive. So there's no de-evolution. It's always just evolution.
So let's go over things that can devolve. Conversations. Radio shows.
Yeah. Especially this one. Yeah. Oh, goodness. I guess it's time for my rant. Oh, boy. Well, speaking of evolution, I had this wonderful encounter. You guys are going to love this. In my never-ending quest to understand the universe, and as such ourselves, we often stumble upon interesting individuals, just like in this show, whose worldviews have me scratching my head. Although well-meaning, this quote-unquote witness of the divine insisted on debating me on the merits of Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. As most of us have learned, the scientific theory of evolution and natural selection is at the base of the diversity of the flora and fauna on our little blue marble in space, and reached consensus eons ago by a scientific community as the explanation of biodiversity, including a remarkable species of primate, Homo sapiens. Evolution isn't true anyway. It's just a theory. Now, the comment took me aback. I had been religious. If I had been religious, I might have been tempted to call blasphemy. It took me a second to recollect myself from the incredulous gaze that must have offered her, and then realized that the conversation had gone into semantics. And although well-intentioned, she didn't understand what a scientific theory meant. It's a common mistake, and one easily rectifiable by anybody with a high school education, or explainable if you don't. As Liam told us today, a theory is defined as a proposed explanation whose status is still conjectural, while a scientific theory is a well-substantiated explanation of some aspect of the natural world, based on knowledge that has been repeatedly confirmed through observation and experimentation. That works for you? Yeah, he nods. In other words, our witness friend thought that the theory of evolution was nothing more than an educated, unproven guess. An easy mistake, for sure, but this educated guess in science is called a hypothesis. And that's from the French, meaning based or under, plus thesis. It was coined around 1640. Is it all coming back to you now? Once the hypothesis had been formulated, tested over and over, reproduced in laboratory experiments, peer-reviewed, and accepted by the scientific community, it is then called a theory. We now know more about evolution than electricity. Yet I doubt that anybody would refute the existence of electricity. Except for the religious community, evolution is simply a fact, one that we can observe either in the fossil record or on a smaller time scale within bacteria and viruses. My grandfather wasn't a monkey, she said in a rather indignant tone. Of course not, but the evidence clearly points out to a common ancestry with apes and all primates. But extended on a timescale of a few million years, it becomes easy to see the chronological ascension into what we are today. Even in one lifetime, we constantly change and evolve. Can you pinpoint exactly what moment you stopped being an infant and became a kid, or a teen, an adult, or a senior? Evolution is a gradual process. From Australopithecus afarensis to Homo sapiens, and projection in the future, where science tells us that our species will undergo much transformations. Will we then be able to call ourselves sapiens, or will we need a new designation? Life is always in motion and change. It has been our adaptability to change that has allowed us to survive this far. Our minds, too, need to adapt to change. Otherwise, our fate will be the same as the dinosaurs. What?
Species do not evolve. Evolution only acts upon larger group.
Oh, like you, goodness.
An individual doesn't change.
All right, fine. I'm dead. I'm not good. Scratch everything I said. I quit the show. I ran over I'm giving this to Liam. This is Liam's show now.
Oh, no. No. evolution acts on the family, not on the individual. Because you need multiple generations for evolution to happen.
You know, you could wait till the show was done. Point of that stuff.
No, no. Everyone needs to know that, right? It's whether or not I have kids, not how I change during my lifetime.
If you want to send your hate mail, you can.
That's
send
epigenetics.
Liam
look
left
up
at
epigenetics.
The Liam at left at the valley.
Thank you, Liam, for being here. Thank you, Jeff, for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, and we got some stuff coming up. Jeff, you got some stuff coming up too, right?
I'm guessing you're talking about the lecture.
Yeah, you get the lecture. And
yeah, September 20th at UFV, 2 p.m., we have a debate between Richard Carrier and Michael Horner. The debate question is, did Jesus exist? And we are continuing to work on our village, so keep tuned to that. And hopefully the city will give us the temporary use permit and allow us to build the village.
Yay, looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I guess that's it for our show. If you guys want to get a hold of us, you can always look at our website, leftatthevalley.com. You can always send us an email, leftatvalley@outlook.com. Thank you guys for being here, and I guess we guys will see you next time.
See you next time.
See you later.